the public, which is used now to a flat digital world where you can get the date, you can get a car, you can get anything you want, a house, literally the speed of light by clicking a computer, suddenly is confronted with government and media that is distant, far away, slow moving, and never listens.
And now, The Good Fight with Yasha Monk.
The 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall passed just a couple of days ago. And I've been thinking back on my own memories of the fall of the wall and what they might mean today. I have a vivid memory of watching the fall of the Berlin Wall live on television when I would have been 7 years old. I see myself in this big, spacious living room following along the events and having some very childlike understanding that people who had been terribly oppressed, who had been unfree, would now be able to live in liberty. But there's one problem with that memory. That big, spacious living room that I'm picturing in my mind belongs to a house in which I and my family did not live until 2 or 3 years after the fall of the wall. I must have seen all of this on a documentary when I was 9 or 10 and misremembered it as seeing it live. What's interesting about this memory is that I think more broadly, we have a false memory of what 1989 was about. As the wonderful political scientist Ivan Khrushchev, who I've had on a previous episode of A Good Fight, has argued, we assumed that 1989 was a liberal democratic revolution, that everybody was united not just in disliking the communist regime, but in wanting liberal democracy. Actually, everybody was united in disliking the communist regime, but what they wanted instead differed. There were people who genuinely were fighting for liberal democratic values, but others who wanted a nationalist revolution that would put an end to Russian occupation of their countries. Others still who disliked the secular nature of the communist regime and wanted more traditional, more religious values. And so something that often seems puzzling becomes legible from that perspective. How is it that so many people in Poland have re-elected the populist regime there, even though it is endangering democracy in crucial ways? Why is it that somebody like Viktor Orban, who was at the forefront of the 1989 revolutions, now is turning himself into a quasi-dictator? Well, the answer is that this isn't exactly a betrayal of the revolution of 1989, though it is a betrayal of what I liked about that revolution. It is a kind of civil war among the different strands of the revolution. That helps to explain both why liberal democracy has not triumphed to the extent that we might have expected 30 years ago, and why it would be premature, too early, to conclude that the reign of liberal democracy is about to end. This civil war has been subterranean for a long time. It is now increasingly visible, and it is clear to me which side of it I stand on. I hope that's true of many of you as well. Now it's my real pleasure to introduce Martin Gury to you. Martin Gury has come to attention with a book called The Revolt of the Public. It is one of the most fascinating, interesting, engaging, and in certain ways puzzling explanations of the importance of the rise of the internet and of digital media for populism and how politics works in the 21st century in general. I've learned a lot from the book. I also wanted to push back on a few of those claims. So you'll see a really interesting conversation in which we explore these crucial issues and in which I try to make sense exactly of what Martin is arguing. It's a good episode, believe me. All right. I hope you enjoy it. Speak to you soon. Welcome to the podcast, Martin.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's set the stage for a moment to understand who you are and how you came to have a really big impact on our debate about the way in which digital technology and the internet are transforming our politics. So you are, by training, a CIA analyst. So how do you think that changes or influences your perspective on politics? That's very different from most of the people I have on the podcast who, you know, by and large are people who spend a lot of time in some ivory tower reading articles in a library or perhaps doing some coding for data. How do you think your experience as a CIA analyst gives you a very different view on politics?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects that really are different from, say, academia or even sometimes State Department was my experience. Number one, as you may or may not know, CIA is not allowed to propose policy. CIA does intelligence, which is sort of like they deliver platonic truth to the president, right? So we can get into that and how feasible that is. But what that trains you as an analyst is not to look for something that you want to happen, but basically to try and understand what the reality on the ground is from the perspective of the people who are actually conducting whatever you're analyzing. So instead of what you get today, which is a lot of top-down interpretation, you want to understand exactly what's going on, and you want to understand it from not an advocate position, but understanding reality. It turns out, in my opinion, and CIA, unfortunately, is a great example of this, getting reality right is tough. Predicting it, which is the second thing CIA is supposed to do, which I never got into and never have believed in, is impossible. Okay, it's impossible. So, but just to get reality right so you can look ahead and say, well, what may happen next is tremendously tough because you do have all these concerns, all these opinions, all these contextual beliefs that drive you to certain conclusions and may blind you to what's going on the ground.
Is there something that you personally in your work, or at least the agency while you were working on, got really wrong in a way that you're allowed to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I think basically CIA exists to prevent discontinuities, right? The CIA exists because of Pearl Harbor. That's the founding event that led to some gigantic intelligence agency existing so that presidents will never be caught so unprepared. Well, ever since then, we've had 9/11, and I can give you a whole roster of discontinuities that CIA got wrong. In fact, CIA gets it right, usually, when tomorrow looks like yesterday, which happens a lot. If you watch the world go, mostly tomorrow looks like yesterday. But that's not what the president wants. He can figure that one out himself. The president wants the next Pearl Harbor, the next 9/11, the next implosion of the Soviet Union. I mean, it is.
And it turns out that systematically the CIA has been unable to predict those. As, by the way, has political science and in a different realm, economics.
I think it's an impossible model. I mean, somebody wants this. Somebody wants this to be so. Somebody wants for some agency to say, this is what's going to be happening tomorrow, Mr. President. But on principle, I believe it's impossible. It's an impossible model. And I mean, when you think about just the implosion of the Soviet Union, it was our strategic enemy for like 50 years. You would have thought that when it fell apart, the Central Intelligence Agency would have some clue. They were completely unprepared. And they were, for months and years afterwards, you could hear rumble. No, they're coming back. They're coming back. They have been weaned into a world in which the Cold War was the reality, and they couldn't wean themselves off of that.
I like, by the way, normally I would interrupt the conversation at this Please. Point because there's a helicopter flying in the background, but I feel like it's nicely themed for our conversation. So please excuse the background noise, but it is a black helicopter monitoring what Martin is saying.
There's probably a sniper on it, too.
Yeah, that's right. So I think the biggest mistake that historians would make is that they look at those moments of radical disjuncture that nobody at the time predicted, or perhaps three or four people predicted for the wrong reasons, because they were cranks who were always going on about something, right? And they then say, well, you know what? This was obvious. And here are all the reasons why it was inevitable that this was happening. So I think, it's amazing when you look at these moments of disjuncture in history and you read history books about them, everything is leading towards them. All of the strands are going there. And it seems like everybody must have known. And when you look at contemporaries, and none of them had an inkling that this was about to happen. And there's something in the distance between those two intellectual worlds which should concern us, I think.
Yeah, and I think scholars and government analysts are very nimble. So if they said one or two words that they could point to, and by the way, they write their reports and their studies this way, just so that you can say, well, I used this word that kind of foreshadowed what happened. So, you could always say, well, I knew it was obvious, I knew it was coming, and then everybody kind of shuffles to the side from, I have no clue, to, of course, we all saw it coming. And you listen to the discourse today about the Soviet Union, well, of course it was collapsing, everybody could see it coming. Well, nobody saw it coming.
Well, so you see, I think that increasingly, I think that a lot of very helpful intellectual ground can be covered, not by predicting things confidently, but by going against the orthodoxies of false certainty. So in my own work, I warned about the threat to democracy from the rise of populism and a bunch of other things. And people sometimes say that I sort of, you know, I'm predicting that all of these democracies will collapse or anything like that. Certainly when I started writing about this before 2016, people thought, this is a crazy view. How can you predict all of this? And my position was always, well, I'm not predicting, you're predicting. Right? The orthodoxy in political science and in public discourse was, we know that these democracies are going to be stable for the next 100 years. And I was not saying, I predict they will collapse. I was saying, I think your certainty is absurd. We cannot know that. And there are some good reasons to think that there's going to be problems. So I don't think I was projecting. They were projecting. And so I think a lot of the times this is the fertile intellectual ground to look for. Where is everybody assuming a particular continuity? And you can stir the pot a little bit and actually make ourselves more, not that you're going to be able to predict the specific discontinuity, but you're able to make us prepared for one of a range of discontinuities by saying, hang on a second, let's be careful about this consensus.
Yes, there were a handful of us, a considerable number, I would say, in my corner of CIA that kind of advocated that approach. The problem is this, if you're inside government, of course, is if you're advocating kind of counterfactual and off the obvious possibilities, you could be wrong a lot of the time. So then you have to have a system, like say the Silicon Valley system, where failure and being wrong is just part of doing business. And government is not that, right? Government is risk averse. And so everybody clusters around the obvious.
Well, I also think it's about whether you're wrong in the same way as everybody else, right? In a place like government, if you're wrong because you didn't see the discontinuity coming, but so was everybody else, what are we going to do? Fire everybody who was wrong and be left with nobody? So nearly as a matter of organizational logic, you have to forgive people for being wrong in the way that everybody else was also wrong. Whereas if you're wrong on your own, it's very easy to say, well, you're just an idiot and a crank and we should probably marginalize you or get rid of you.
In government, being wrong is just deadly. You don't ever want to be tagged as, you know, if you made a call and you failed. So you basically, there's stuff you write it very mushily so that you can always claim some part of that stepped into what actually happened, and then cluster around the obvious and the immediate, and tomorrow's like yesterday, and don't take leaps. I had a friend, now dead, and sadly a brilliant guy, who when the information explosion in the digital age began to blossom all over the world, started to see in a country like Egypt, where all you had was silence. If it wasn't government mandated, you didn't hear it, all right? And suddenly there's all these voices mocking Hosni Mubarak, angry at Hosni Mubarak. And it was startling. And he wrote a paper and he couldn't get it anywhere. He had it back and kept it for the rest of his life because it looked like somebody had slashed their wrist. And it had so many red marks on it that it was like one gigantic blot of red. And number one, they told him, well, you're not an Egypt analyst, and which was true. But number two, it was like, well, who are these people? Why should I care about these people?
Right.
And this is completely off of what we're watching. Mubarak is going to basically pass on the presidency to his son Gamal. And this is, he's called the Pharaoh. He's been there 30 years. And so you cluster around the safe and obvious. And if you do what my friend did, you get red marked to death, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, that's depressing. So you started writing a book about how the internet is transforming our politics. And I want to get into the book in a moment. I have to say it is one of the books I was most exhilarated to read in the last years. It has deep insight and idiosyncratic and very engaging style. And, you know, it's been a long time since I've read a sort of book of serious analytical nonfiction and felt like I was as drawn to the next page as in a novel. This is serious praise, and I mean every word of it. I also sometimes am puzzled by the argument or unsure about what the argument actually is. I've taught the text a few times, and I sometimes struggle to actually be very clear. I feel lost at certain points. So I want to dissect the book a little bit. But before we get there, it has an interesting publication history. So you self-published it.
Yes.
And then it started making the rounds somehow in Silicon Valley. And then,
Well, actually what happened was, I mean, you were talking about predictions. This is a funny, the golden instance of this. Yeah, I self-published in 2014, mainly because I didn't want editors. I just felt like this is what I had to say. We can go into the genesis of the idea if you want to. But basically, this is something that had been stirring, not just with me, but with a a number of my colleagues in CIA. I had left CIA for many years when I wrote it, but the thought remained with me. I self-published, and it did okay. It did okay. And then your friend Donald Trump got elected, all right?
Friend Donald Trump.
Yes, yeah, I know you love him. So basically, I'm a Trump profiteer. I mean, everybody said, this is the man who predicted Donald Trump. There isn't a word about Donald Trump in the book, by the way. There just isn't a word. So let's get intellectually honest. I did not predict Donald Trump. I basically put frameworks in place that if you follow the point, yes, there were several people. Silicon Valley, I'm a hero there. I'm a zero in Washington, but I'm a hero in Silicon Valley. And this new Stripe Press, started by a 29-year-old billionaire, that tries to imagine that, called Patrick Collison, who's also a certified genius, was looking for books to publish. And so what I did for the second edition is I updated it. Trump is there all the way to like 2018. So I updated it from 2014 to 2018. It was published late in 2018, and it's been doing pretty well.
So the title of your book is The Revolt of the Public. And, you know, when you hear public in that context, it's tempting to think we're talking about one unified public, as you're seeing in some ways today in Hong Kong or perhaps in Bolivia or in Chile. You know, there is a sort of consensus opinion in society. They get really pissed off with the people in power. They come out sort of as one, they revolt, right? That's very different from what you mean, right? You have a sort of technical definition of what you mean by the public. So what, in your mind, does the revolt of the public actually mean?
Well, I mean, I think what I try to capture is that that's always a reality on the ground. And I always try starting out by saying what the public is not. It's not the people, of which, of course, the public always wants to claim it is. That's just a category of political philosophy. And it's not the masses, which is kind of an old-fashioned 20th century term. It's not even the crowd on the street, even though I would say in the day of the digital device, the crowd and the public have a very intimate relationship. As you would say in Facebook, it's complicated. The reality on the ground is quite the opposite of what you said. The public is not one, it's many. It's many. It's highly fractured. The public that I describe is what remains after this tidal wave of information has swept away these large institutional mass organizations that sort of homogenize the public into making one or very few choices, right? And the public never was that. It went with the choices it was given. Once you remove those institutional forces and you allow the public its own voice, you realize it's got dozens, hundreds, many, many voices, right? The dynamic, as I see it, is that, therefore, whenever you are trying to gather around any positive program, you have a lot of yelling and screaming and disagreement. Whenever you try to gather around a negation of the system, you try to gather around the feeling of distance and alienation from power, but not just power, also from many other institutional structures like media, for example, you can gather people from many different beliefs and opinions just on that point of negation, battering away at the institutions of power and information and so forth.
So, right. I mean, when you think of something like Tahrir Square and the way that that revolution in Egypt then developed, you can see the distinction very easily. It's easy for people to come together and say, this guy, Hosni Mubarak, has ruled us for decades. Things aren't going very well. Let's get rid of him. Once he's gone and you have to agree on how should our society be ruled and what do we want to do now, it becomes much, much more difficult and the fissures come out. In a way, that's true of 1989 in Central and Eastern Europe as well. Right? It was easy to say we hate this regime and we gave one kind of interpretation to what the revolution was, but actually was many different strains of what people wanted. And that's playing out in the kind of fight between liberals and authoritarians and more secular and more religious people and nationalists and Europeanists throughout the region now. But when you're talking about this revolt of the public, so what does it mean? I mean, I think there's a phrase you have in your book that is sort of these self-assembled different groups. So why are they more powerful now than they used to be? I mean, they always existed in a certain kind of way. Why is it that a public, because there's multiple publics in your understanding, right? So yes. A public, like the people who really care about X, about veganism or about a very strict interpretation of Islam or about getting rid of immigrants or whatever it is. Why is it that they have become more powerful through these technological changes we've seen?
Part of it is that they have become more powerful, and the reason is pretty straightforward. I think they now have access to infinite amounts of information for all practical purposes, and which they can not only consume, but they can produce. So they have a voice, and they have an informed voice insofar as they're interested in that. But I think equally as important, if not more so, is that the institutions that they seem to be in rebellion against have been crippled by this tsunami of information that began with the digital age. They were essentially predicated on owning little monopolies of information for their own domain. So if you were in the government, like I was, you had your own pot of information that nobody else could look at, all right? If you were the New York Times, you had your own pot of information that nobody else could look at. And so you as an information provider had a lot of prestige because you were handing out a valuable commodity, right? And if you happened to be wrong, you could always fudge it. And if you happen to be really, really wrong, you could be disgraced, but the system was fine. You were just a bad egg in a good system, right? Mm-hmm. Today, with that information sweeping across the institutions, every error, every blunder, every misstep, every failure, every bad call in terms of what's going to happen next, as we were talking about before, is not only out in the open, but it's center stage. Mm. It's center stage. The public is watching this. So these people who have posed as sort of platonic guardians, we know best, we have the access to information, we will manage the institutions, and you will be rewarded with a good government and good media. Suddenly you realize you're seeing the sausage being made, and you have a sense that these people are as clueless as you are.
So I'm hearing two slightly different points here, which go together. I don't think there's a tension between them. So the first is that there's just not the same information advantage that media and political elites have compared to ordinary people who might be interested in a topic, right? It used to be that if you are the journalist on that beat of the New York Times, or if you are a CIA analyst, you had a ton of access to what people are saying, to documents, to all kinds of things that an ordinary person 500 miles away just could not access, right? And so that's why the information you were given from something like the New York Times was objectively very valuable to you because it synthesized stuff to which you didn't have access. The second point, which I think is slightly separate, but again, complementary, is that, well, when people get it wrong, you couldn't really complain. You could write a letter to the editor, you could grouse to your friends, but now there's this very public process in which, you know, a journalist gets something wrong and everybody immediately points it out on Twitter. And so there's a sort of much deeper
feedback. Yeah, and I would add that it's more than having had an advantage. I think what has happened touches on the authority and the legitimacy of these institutions. That's what they rested on. They rested on knowing. And now they're shown as not knowing. And now the public, as you say, in addition, has the voice to say, you essentially lied to us. You pretended to be something you were not. And I think by the nature of these institutions, which are very hierarchical, very pyramidal, the public, which is used now to a flat digital world where you can get the date, you can get a car, you can get anything you want, a house, literally the speed of light by clicking a computer, suddenly is confronted with government and media that is distant, far away, slow moving, and never listens. Part of the old model was it was in broadcast mode, it spoke, but it did not hear, all right? It was just incapable of that, and it still is. So that has, I think, instilled a great deal of alienation. We can talk about how realistic the public is, and it is my take that the public is driven by a lot of utopian expectations. In other words, much of what the public wants from government is what the government used to promise, but I think we now know that those promises were not fulfilled. But the public is still insisting somehow. And in fact, even more so, there's an even existential aspect to this. A lot of these protests go on indefinitely, the Gilets jaunes in France, because these are people who were nothing, right? And now they're somebodies. The media is there taking their activities and seriously and interviewing them and so forth. So giving that up means going back to being a nobody. So there are several layers to this, but the incentive is the public is probably going to find something to spark up about.
So I'm still trying to understand why this is such a transformation of a political system, right? So, okay, you have these old institutions that worked on information advantage and hierarchy and prestige. You have a brilliant bit in the book where you talk about the fact that the names used to be quite stodgy. It was sort of a public broadcasting corporation and the New York Times and so on. And now you have these new entrants which democratize access to information, They're not called the National Search Engine Corporation. They're right. called Google. And they allow everybody access to all this information. And so as a result, there's a crisis of trust. This sort of elite consensus is challenged much more. I get all of that. But why does that dissolve the hold that political institutions have, that traditional economic institutions have, to such an extent? I'm not sure that I've yet understood why that is a phase shift in human history.
Basically, in every society, you need a class that decides the old New Testament question, Pontius Pilate, what is truth? There's a class that says, this is so. I mean, I was a member of CIA. That's what we did to the president. Mr. President, this is really the way it is. It's not what you're reading in the paper. This is so. All right. When that class is delegitimized, as it is completely now, when it is not replaced by another class, which is normally what happens, you have both when communism took over and then when it was overthrown, a new class took over that then served those functions. That's not what's happening now. The public is not interested in taking over. The public is not interested in power. The public is interested in telling government to do things that government probably cannot do. And the basic function is, when there are disputes, not only of opinion, but of facts, but of the interpretation of the world as it is. You always are living within this big framework that everybody shares, and that all the debates and disputes happen within that framework. You take that framework and you smash it. It's like a big mirror. You smash it on the ground, and all you have is fragments now. And that's where we are. The system, I think, is breaking down because you can't even agree on fundamentals. You can't even agree on what is and what is not. And part of it is perspectival. And I always say that's something that the elites always got wrong. The elites are the people who run these institutions that I've been talking about. That wasn't CIA, I can tell you this. If you're an elite, everybody else had a perspective, you had scientific truth. So you spoke, you know, ex cathedra as an authority. And yeah, they told you, yeah, but I think this, I think that. Yeah, but that's because if you were where I am, you would see differently. So shut up and listen. That is gone. That is completely gone. And yet the modes of thinking and behaving and their rhetoric from the top of these organizations, from the elites, hasn't changed. So you still have that feeble attempt at, you know, well, yes, I know, but the public isn't buying it anymore. And the public, in those fractured pieces of the old truth, you know, you have those talk about post-truth. Yeah, of course, I'm not a postmodernist. If you're standing on a street and a truck is coming at you, is it really a truck? Is it real? You get out of the way. I mean, the reality is reality. But reality can be seen from many different perspectives, okay? If you're standing at the top of the Empire State Building, New York City kind of looks like the heavenly city, right? If you're standing at the bottom of the Empire State Building and there's a bum puking on the corner and there's people, you know, honking their cars, it's like hell, right? It's the opposite. Same New York, different perspectives, all right?
So, and different valuations. I kind of love the New York of honking, puking, bum. But
you're unique in that.
Perhaps. No, I think a lot of what people love about New York is its raw energy and over cares and so on and so forth. So I'm not unique. But again, okay, I see how that makes our politics more contentious. I see how that explains a sense of freewheeling chaos that you see in lots of places. But I do think that this leads to a kind of conclusion in what you just said and in the book, that all of these hierarchical institutions will eventually be swept aside and that the revolt of the public will replace them. And I have sort of two questions here, right? The first is, what will they replace them with? Is it possible to replace these hierarchical institutions with something else? Or will you just end up getting continual contestation of those institutions, an ongoing, perhaps permanent trust crisis and so on, but without substitution? Let's start with that question.
Yeah, as you know, I don't do predictions. That's a CIA business model, and it's pretty failed. The question, do we need hierarchies? I mean, you can have the discussion, but I don't know how you can run a modern society without some sort of hierarchies. Do we need the hierarchies as steep and as industrial model as we have now? No, that's something that was just a historical accident, that we became the way we are somewhere in the early 20th century. It became progressively more so, and we could flatten the structures. It had to still be a hierarchy, but it could be much flatter, okay? Does the public want to replace the hierarchies? The public has no interest in replacing the hierarchies. The public, really, when you get down to it, is interested in bashing away at them. The public has very few positive traits. And there are moments when you could say, and Hosni Mubarak was one instance in Egypt, where you could say, well, okay, that's it. I would, if I were an Egyptian, be ready to bash that institution. And there are moments where, to me, it strikes me as nihilistic almost. What happened in Chile just recently, where the price of transportation, of mass transit, went up, and the answer that that particular public responded with was burn down huge sections of that transportation system. That is nihilism at some point. And if you ask the public that is engaged in this, the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests in France, which I've studied pretty well, they tell you, well, you have to do this. You have to do it, because if you don't destroy things, nobody pays attention to you. Mm. So we're caught in this sort of dynamic where the public is not interested in replacing, it's interested in bashing. And the hierarchies right now, at this moment, the elites right now, are not interested in reforming, they're interested in clinging to what they got. And these most extraordinary changes like Brexit or like Trump, it's like, no, we have to somehow go back to before. We can't accept that this ever happened. This is an impossibility. This is a glitch in the matrix, and it violates my sense of reality. So in some weird way or another, we're going to reactionary mode and bring the world back to where it was before Trump and before Brexit. And it never occurs to these elites to listen to what the public is saying with a very loud voice and to think, well, how can you maintain these institutions in a form that's at least semi-authoritative with this public the way it is. Clearly not by the way you're acting right now. New changes need to be made.
So what would those changes look like? Because I agree that, as you're saying, the industrial hierarchies of an early age are probably unsustainable. And frankly, there's good reasons to change them, because there's probably ways to use new technologies to organize those aspects of our countries, of our lives much better. And I also agree that you need to take the rise of populism seriously as an expression of deep discontent. It's not just people woke up one morning and got crazy. And so promising real changes that respond to that anger is the only way we can keep the system together. But I also find that a lot of the things that people sell in this space is snake oil, that there's a lot of sort of very half-baked ideas about how to use digital democracy and all kinds of things that have never been tested, and I think for quite deep reasons would not work. And as you're saying, there is also this nihilistic streak in the public, and you want to make sure that you don't give in to that, right? You're not going to say, all right, look, let's just burn down the whole transport system, because like no responsible person should say that. So what does this actually mean? What should we be doing? How can we be reinventing these institutions?
Well, I mean, I don't know how many layers there are between you and me and the president of the United States. But I can tell you, the fact that I don't know right there, I can tell you probably hundreds of layers, all right? I worked in government. I can tell you the government could be a lot flatter. The hierarchies that exist today can be a lot flatter and a lot more responsive. And yes, I'm with you. I think e-democracy is a nice dream. I think you can make certain aspects of your official data digitized. You know, Estonia has done this, and it gives people security that their data. You can even look at what the police have on you. You can request it and you get it. It's there. All your data is yours. You own it. I think that is a step in the right direction. But as an e-democracy where we all kind of meet in this gigantic forum called the internet and decide, that's not going to work. That's just not going to work. So what you need is a few things. And I guess you have to ask, what are the complaints of the public writ large? All right. What is the public rebelling against? And when you listen to the elites, there's always some elite obsession like globalism or racism or whatever. But honestly, what I have read, what these revolts, which are very articulate people in them, are constantly talking about it. What they themselves say, okay, so what are the themes? And I see two themes that seem to dominate pretty much every revolt. And that was from the ones that looked way back in 13 and 14 to the ones that are going on right now in 2019. One is distance. And I guess it manifests itself differently in different countries, as these things always have. And that has not changed. But say in the US, it kind of works like this. Okay, you are my neighbor. I just voted for you to become my representative in Washington.
Right.
You used to be just like me. You used to talk just like me. Hmm. Now you've disappeared into the top of the pyramid. Hmm. I'm looking at you on TV. You don't even look like you anymore. You don't sound like anybody around here anymore. Yeah. And I'm yelling at you about, look, we have concerns, and you're not paying any attention to me. You seem to be very interested in talking to all these other powerful people. Mm. You've disappeared into the top of the pyramid, and you're not really my representative. You are just in it for yourself, and I'm going to pay the bill. That is almost invariably an aspect of every revolt. And I think actually there's a lot of truth to it, because that old industrial model is exactly like that. You are put up at the top of the pyramid, and you're really not there to talk to the people at the bottom of it. Mm. You're there to interact with the other elites. I think we need to understand that that can't go on like that.
And this, by the way, is a particular problem for left-wing parties around the world. I mean, it's amazing what left-wing parties have gone from being the parties that serve people with fewer qualifications and less income, to the ones that serve people with higher educations and to some extent higher income.
Has completely
flipped.
And this
is true of the Democratic Party in the United States. It's also true of most left-wing parties in Europe. I mean, I think there is questions about what a meaningful shallow hierarchy would look like. And what a lot of populists do is a simulacrum of responsiveness. They talk in a crass way. They sort of, you know, echo the things that people are really angry about. But often, I don't think they take the worries that people have very seriously, and they certainly don't actually end up helping with the things that make them upset. And so I think the danger is that this produces a cheap simulacrum of being close to the people.
Yeah, no, I think there's any question about that. I mean, when you look at, for example, the Trump voters, there have been all kinds of stereotyping of them, but it really were quite a diverse coalition, okay? Mm-hmm. But a large majority of them said, I like him because he talks just like me.
Mm, yeah.
All right. So, I mean, what that means, we will leave unexamined right now. But that's what the way they felt about it. But look at Trump. I mean, he's a man who names towers after himself. This isn't a man who's going to flatten governments, you know, in the least. Right. So you're 100% correct. However, if you want an indication of how things might change, I'll put two people who are of the exact opposites of a political spectrum. Trump is one, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the other. They are constantly present to their base. They are not distant because of their use, in Trump's case, of Twitter, although he seems to be getting weirder and weirder about that. But and it has worked so far that his base feels that he's there. Mm. He is projecting that voice that is his voice. And I mean, I read his book because I felt like I had to read The Art of the Deal.
Right.
Everybody says, well, it was ghostwritten. But you could hear his voice, right? He was talking, all right? It's the same damn guy who was out there now talking about whatever. And you could hear his voice in his tweets. I mean, there he is. He's not far away. He's right here. AOC, she basically made a personal diary out of Instagram with tremendous political import. So she has like, she talks about politics, of course, but she has like little makeup sessions where she talks about how she puts on. Suddenly, she's a person. Hmm. She's not some, you know.
You don't see the finished product. You see the person who becomes the finished product in certain contexts when she has to put up the makeup or whatever.
Yes.
But you also see sort of the things she very cleverly tweeted about, you know, how it's decided who gets which office and what that looks like and so on. So, you get to go in the adventure with
her. And there is a definition of that that's gained a lot of, I think, credibility, is that these are two people who, whatever else they may be, are very authentic, right? I completely disagree with that. I completely disagree with that. I mean, think of Trump. He lives in front of cameras. AOC puts the camera in front of herself, okay? You cannot be authentic when you have a... These are just extraordinary performers. These are people who are extraordinary performers and can convey a sense of themselves, whatever that might be, to a public that is very hungry for that. Mm. Very hungry for that. These are not people who are talking in that weird jargon and talking as if they know and I don't, and who are condemning me for my opinions because they may not fit their model of what my opinion should be. These are people who are just like me.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing where, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, it was the era of the perfected sort of PR politician, right? Yeah. The politician who has the perfect soundbite for everything, who always looks good, whose tie is always the appropriate one, and so on and so forth.
Tony Blair.
Yeah, and a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
You know. And I think now you're in the era where there's a counter reaction against that. And it's interesting when you look at how many very old politicians have suddenly been fashionable. I mean, you can see that obviously in the three leading politicians of the Democratic Party right now. But, you know, I think the best examples are Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn. And I don't actually think that it's so much the appeal of their particular political program. And it's not so much the appeal that they are the best speakers in the hall. I mean, Bernie Sanders certainly has his own kind of charm, but, you know, he's like an older guy who just like goes on about the same thing all of the time, you know. But that is authentic, right? He has been banging on about the same stuff for 40 years when people didn't like it, and he was happy to do it in 50 people in a back room. And now he does it in the presidential debate stage. And so it is this sort of, it is negative space in a weird way. It is the denial of the distance that draws people to them. And then I think you're right that somebody like AOC is now probably the inheritor of that. You know, with somebody like Bernie Sanders, there was sort of negative space in a certain kind of way, and AOC is the sort of younger version who actually grew up in this new world and doesn't embody it sort of by default because they were always a weird outsider, but because they are sort of coming in as the mainstream of this new movement in an odd way.
So to your question, though, to get a little deeper into that, part of the answer to this part is generational, I think. Okay? I think that the art of dealing with digital platforms in such a way that you seem to be talking to somebody who doesn't want to be lectured at or sneered down at, but you sound like his next door neighbor, that is going to, I suspect, be a lot more of a visible trait of the next generation of politicians and of elites. And in part, I think what we need, I mean, honestly, is elite house cleaning. And there are a lot of young elites with old heads, so it's not just generational. I think you need elites that understand that, number one, the old act doesn't work anymore. The old act is failed, okay? You can give reasons whether it's objectively failed or not. Doesn't really matter. It's failed in the eyes of the public. And until that gets resolved and authority is restored to the system that the elites manage, nothing is going to happen in a positive way. And you need somebody who then is willing to address that. So what does need to be done? One of the things is the rhetoric has to be very different. The behavior has to be very different. If you're Mark Zuckerberg, you go meet bankers in your t-shirt and sweatpants. This guy could buy the world over 20 times, but that's what he does. Okay, it's kind of a message. It's not the National Bank of the United States. It's Facebook. He's saying...
Well, it was right. I mean, especially at its origin, it was a message of saying, I'm not part of the old world of business. This is a new world of business.
Right. I am not wearing the old school tie.
Now, that, of course, has become its own convention.
Yes.
In Silicon Valley now, sort of, you know, $500 t-shirt that looks like it's $10 is the new Brooks Brothers suit. But that's fine. It's been a shift change, right? We've been talking all this while about the first theme you mentioned.
Yes.
So you said one thing that all these pros have in common and that they all complain about is distance. And I think the last 10 minutes of our conversation has been about distance. So I'm intrigued to hear what's the second one.
Second one is failure. The sense that the people at the top have failed in every respect, and failure is invariably interpreted not as incompetence, but as corruption, all right? It's not really that they have failed. It's just that they're not interested in succeeding for me. They all succeed in their own terms. They all seem to, no matter how well or badly they do, they end up pretty well off, but they're not listening. I am being failed by them, okay? I honestly think this is where the utopian expectations come in, okay? Mm. I honestly think that's an interesting one because in many of the revolts that I have studied, when you look at the objective conditions of the people who were in revolt, it was better than their parents, way better than their grandparents. These were people who had, most of them, high levels of education. They all had digital devices that were masters of the digital world. You don't do that if you're a poor person or a marginal person. I mean, if you look at the revolt of the public, there are no poor people, there are no marginal people, there are no discriminating minorities with one or two possible exceptions. And it's people who actually, both from the terms of the world and from a perspective of history, and I don't know what other standard you can judge by, are pretty well off, but feel not that way. Feel failed by the people who are in charge and feel like they ought to be doing somehow better.
So what's, and I'm sorry to be so solution-minded,
yeah,
but what's the solution to that? Because on the first one of distance, that's difficult to resolve, but we've talked about some of the ways in which new generations might be able to produce at least the illusion of being close to people. And once that's become the new mode in politics, perhaps it'll stabilize certain things. Well, I mean, how on earth, if people have these utopian expectations, if they've actually lead relatively good lives, they have an education, they have a good income, but they still feel all of the elites have failed, we should blow the system up. How is that ever going to change?
Well, I mean, I always say the first politician that tells me, I don't have all the answers, but let's try this. And if this doesn't work, we will tweak it and do trial and error. Trial and error has been the only process through which the human race has advanced, okay? Nobody has ever sat down in a corner and come up with some magnificent replacement to what is standing on the ground. So whenever that politician says that to me, I'll vote for him or her. Basically, you're now sliding out of politics and bumping almost into morality, moral grounds, right? The industrial model of political discourse promised great changes. It was utopian, right? I mean, essentially revolution was the end point. And you could say, well, we can get there violently or we can get there peacefully by reform. But there was this progressive end point that was utopia, right? And everything was directed that way. And it was directed that way in the democracies. It was directed that way in the totalitarian governments, right and left. So that has been removed. Nobody believes in revolution anymore. And nobody thinks it's possible, but nobody thinks it's good. So now we have a system that has no endpoint, right? But we still have that rhetoric of, I will change, I will do. And the public has absorbed this and is throwing it back at the politicians. The difference is now they can tell where the failures are.
That's fascinating. I mean, you would assume that this sort of very staid, rule-bound, hierarchical politics of old would go together with relatively limited promises and a sense that the outside world is going to continue being more or less the same, and that the new, more chaotic era of a revolt of the public would be the one in which people want these utopian goals. But you're sort of inverting it. You're saying that actually a lot of the time the old industrial hierarchical politics claimed that it was able to produce a revolution in the outside world, and perhaps the way to manage the world of the public is to cease making big promises that you keep failing at delivering and actually go into saying, hey, I can't give you very much, but perhaps I can give you these couple of small things and I'll do my best.
Yes.
There's something paradoxical about that, isn't
it? Well, if you look at the history of that old model, not really. That really was what the old model was about. If you have enough data and you have science on your side and you have a class of people who are sort of not moved by, you know, irrational exuberance or opinions and emotions, then you can solve the human condition. I mean, that really was the promise of the old modern world. We will solve the human condition. We will have equality, we will have affluence, we will have freedom of expression and enriched lives. And it usually, in the old ways, is what they call high modernism, usually manifested itself in these gigantic projects, which were horrible in the totalitarian countries, but not so great in democracies. My favorite is always the city of Brasilia.
I was thinking about Brasilia because I was there in April.
Yes, it's a crazy place.
It is a crazy place. Yes. And, you know, when you look at some of those photographs, they look kind of nice. And then when you're in the city, it is a terrible place to live.
It actually, today, I think it's 2/3 of it is unplanned because that's the way all those plans have gone, right? In the end, the public in its own way took over and rebuilt Brasilia. But that core part of Brasilia promised, and the president, whose name escapes me now, that built it, promised to compress 50 years of progress in 5 by building Brasilia. Well, by the end of the time Brasilia was built, people have forgotten that promise. It had no effect on the Brazilian economy whatsoever. It took years for anything to even happen there because the politicians didn't want to move away from Rio, as you might well imagine. Most of them still live in Rio and travel for business.
In Sao Paulo, yeah.
Yeah, Sao Paulo. But, I mean, you look at that place and it is like a perfect example. They built these gigantic highways, 10 lanes wide, and no sidewalks.
Yeah.
No sidewalks. Because why? Well,
every worker is going to have a car.
Yeah. Oh, there were no workers there. I mean, and the other thing is that only the elites in here, the assumption was only the people at the top are going to be in Brasilia. There was no working class. In fact, many of the people who built Brasilia stayed in a very unplanned way and built their own little shanties on the margins. And other people came who were wealthier and built nicer places. But it's this idea that you could solve problems from the top by being rational and being scientific and then being dispassionate. And this wasn't a question of politics and values. It was a question of science. There's only one answer. The old way talked, and we still talk that way, and I have tried to train myself not to do it, talked about human circumstances, political relationships, social relationships as problems, right? A problem is a mathematical equation.
Right, right.
That has one solution, right? You can't have, you just have a simple one, one and one. You can't have five. You have to have two, right? So that was the model. We spoke about problems. So I'm the person who worked out the equation for equality. That's my claim. Well, you should elect me. I've worked out that equation. Well, of course, what we now know, and Paul Ormerod has a book called Why Most Things Fail that I recommend to anybody who's interested in this. We now know that we don't know. We don't know. Nobody knows. The government doesn't know. Industry doesn't know. Corporations don't know. So the idea that you can plan ahead and deliver this, in the end, revolutionary changes by just following some mathematical construct in your mind.
So then, you know, your prescription, insofar as you give one on this, is to say, why don't politicians go and say, I'm going to try my best. I'm going to try a bunch of different things. Yeah. We might make a little bit of progress, but no huge promises. I think that responds to a very real problem you have in politics, right? I mean, one of the ways in which people lose trust in a political system is that at each election, an inspiring politician or a politician that tries to be inspiring comes in and says, I'm going to transform this country. Things will be so much better. And that's certainly, in a way, what Obama did in his way and then Trump did in his very, very different way.
Totally. Right?
And then, of course, you know, systems are very sticky and they're complicated and the means that the government has at its disposal are limited. And as you're saying, it's not clear that they're always taking the right measures in any case. And so they might make a little bit of progress in something, but really reality remains relatively unchanged. And so that produces this sense of elite failure. They keep promising these huge things and I don't actually see any change. So why should we trust anything these people say, right? So what you're saying is that we should make these very limited promises and that you would vote for that politician. But, you know, you are an elite, Martin, I'm sorry to say. And it's not clear to me that so many of you and my compatriots would join in this vision, would actually be willing to vote for a politician who says, I'm boring, I'm going to try and do my best, and perhaps you'll get a little bit of something, but I can't really promise you anything much. Do you think that that will actually win against the people who are willing to say, you know, the problem is, all these people have promised you things, but they weren't willing to smash things. I'm going to smash things, and then you'll be able to get everything, I promise you.
Yeah, right.
Which
now...
Which is a populist, in a sense.
Right now, no. Right now, no. But, okay, we are in the very, very early stages of what is, I think, a radical transformation from the industrial age to something that doesn't even have a name yet, okay? And I am not a believer, like Marx was, in these unshakable forces of history. I believe that we all have a part to play. It may be a small part, or maybe a bigger part, but we all have a part to play. And that really is where I think, you know, and I'm kind of uncomfortable because I am, morality to me is something that I don't particularly want to preach at people, but at least contemplate the moral field. Because we today, I mean, I think the public today outdoes the politicians in terms of saying, well, I'm going to save the earth. I want to save the earth, okay? And I'm going to save the earth by doing this. I'm going to save the earth by doing that. It's these incredibly preposterous ideas that your personal life can have that kind of a cosmic influence. And I think it in part is because people are existentially hungry and they don't have religion anymore and they don't have cohesive communities. Many of them don't even have cohesive families anymore. So they're looking for politics to give them what politics can't give, okay? But honestly, people who want to change the world, the conversations I have had is, you know, can you lose 10 pounds in like 3 weeks? Because if you can't change yourself, and most people, you look at them and you go, well, probably not, right? Mm. Yeah. If you can't change yourself, how would you change the world? Hmm. Reality is hard. Reality is not easy. And I think the idea that reality is easy, except for these bad people at the top, that's where we are right now. So the people at the top are saying, yeah, I'm with you. And yes, everybody else but me is bad. So vote for me. They're feeding that frenzy. But in fact, that's not the case. The people at the top are clueless. There's no question about that. And some of them are bad, but mostly not. Mm. Mostly they're responding to what they think the public wants. And I think the public ought to want what is achievable. I think it's really on you and it's really on me not to say, by golly, the president ought to do this and ought to do that and ought to do the other, and to be maybe a little more forgiving of failure and certainly a lot more realistic about what politics can do for an individual who is, as we said before, so many, many, many layers removed from the precedent. I mean, it's not like what influence does Donald Trump have on my personal life? Zero. So I have an influence in my personal circle as to how I influence in this regard of negation, nihilism. You know, are you always complaining, or are you just kind of trying to understand, or are you trying to looking for a better way forward? This slides away from politics into morality. It's kind of uncomfortable, but I don't see how you can avoid it.
No, that's very convincing to me. And by the way, this piece about never ascribing to malevolence what you can ascribe to incompetence, I think is key. I mean, I think it's amazing, and it goes with the theme of what you've been saying, how many people deeply believe in conspiracy theories. I mean, if you go out there and talk to ordinary people, you know, a huge number of people really do believe in some form of conspiracy theory. And so I found myself in these arguments where I'm trying to argue against the sort of conspiracist mindset. And I thought, I wonder if the only argument that works a little bit, and only a little bit, is to say, well, look, imagine you and your 10 best friends got together and you had a weekend to hash out a detailed plan for what should happen. Would you be able to agree? Would all of you actually be able to say, yes, we want all of these things? No, you just argue for 2 days and then go away without having come to an agreement. So how are all of these Bilderbergs and all of these conspiracies supposed to work? It's just people are not that competent. I think the conspiracist mindset nevertheless retains a strong hold. I want to end the conversation by pushing you a little bit on another aspect of the book. So, you know, because of the greater availability of information, because these publics can self-assemble in anger and sort of take things down, you think that the public is at this point much stronger than these old-fashioned, hierarchical, industrial age institutions. And so what we can expect is more chaos, flatter hierarchies, more legitimacy crises, and so on. I have one worry about all of this, which is that the playing field may be very different for old industrial age institutions in democracies compared to dictatorships. So here, you know, the New York Times can't say, shut up with your criticism of what we've been writing. The president can't say, well, if you assemble to protest, I'm just going to shoot at you. But of course, determined dictators can, right? So when the hierarchy is not tied, as the famous phrase goes about democracy, with one hand behind its back, when it's fighting all out by telling the people below them in the hierarchy, and the most hierarchical element of any state is the army, to go out and shoot at the protesters, to go out and shut down critical media outlets and all of those kinds of things, it may actually be able to weather the revolt of the public. And if that's true, if there's a principled advantage for hierarchical institutions that are willing to use any form of force in order to stay in power, compared to hierarchical institutions of a form that we used to have in democracies, then this technological shift may actually favor dictatorships over democracies. Now, again, I'm not projecting that this will happen, but I think it's a real worry that hierarchical institutions that are willing to use brute force in order to sustain themselves may prove one of the real winners of this moment. So I'm interested in hearing what you think about that.
Well, I don't think it has to do with power. I think it has to do with information. It's the old dictator's dilemma, right? If you're a dictator, you want to be legitimate. If you want to be legitimate, you have to be prosperous. I mean, that's, you weren't elected, so you want to create economic prosperity. If you want to create economic prosperity, you have to open up for information, because otherwise businesses can be conducted. But if you open up for information, then people are going to start criticizing you. So you can either try to ride that tiger, or you can shut it down. People like the regimes like the one in North Korea and Cuba, they basically shut it down. And yeah, they have ridden out the revolt to the public quite comfortably. Thank you very much. China has allowed a lot. Iran, to some extent, a lot. Particularly China, I feel, they are dependent on that prosperity continuing. And let's watch and see what happens, because the prosperity is not continuing, as far as I can tell. Let's see what happens, because they have all the elements in place for a revolt of the public there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And now, if you move over to the democracies, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. I see what happened in Chile, where the police and the military started shooting people, and the response was the opposite of what was intended. The entire public as a whole, public opinion as a whole, swung against the government, even though these people have been doing some very vandalistic and non-productive, burning down the mass transit, therefore inconveniencing and sometimes making it impossible for people to earn a living. The police acted with brutality or strength. They showed strength, which maybe in different contexts, a different age, would have been acceptable. And it backfired. I always say, I know your point of view, and I mean, I'm waiting and watching. It may well be that they come say, and let's hope not, knock on wood, an evil political genius that can take this information environment and somehow turn it to the advantage of a dictatorship, right? That hasn't happened, and the tendency to me is in the exact opposite direction. What is happening is this nihilistic public just allowing itself, you know, this orgy of bashing at institutions without a thought as to what should be in its place. So information is not power that matters. And in the democracies, in the old democracies, like I said, keep an eye open. I come from Cuba, okay? By the time I was 10 years old, I had had a right-wing dictatorship and a left-wing dictatorship. I can smell one, okay? So I'm not going to say it can't happen because I know that it can, but it hasn't. And the framework and the tendency is against that. The old mass movements were the ultimate in industrial organization. You had one person at the top and everything was ordained of every layer down. That just is almost impossible to carry out today. There are no mass movements today. And if you don't have a mass movement, how can you have a true dictatorship? I guess if the army is willing to shoot enough people, but in a democracy, I don't see that happening.
Martin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, this was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. This podcast is generously supported by the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about this show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be like, rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license. Thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.